Trump administration says it will find a way to ask about citizenship on the U.S. Census. This immigration activist is not deterred.
There is a duty for all of us to be able to fill out the census and be counted.
Also, the government in Italy shuts down a migrant detention center in Sicily where migrants have been landing for years.
I think Sicily is a little different because we've been welcoming migrants since the 1980s, and at the time there were no headlines.
And a medical school in Edinburgh rights a historic wrong when 7 women students were harassed until they left without a degree 150 years ago.
So as the women approached the gate, there was rubbish that was hurled at them and mud that was hurled at them, and they were very verbally abused as well.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. President Trump wants a citizenship question on the 2020 census, and he's not backing down, not even after the Supreme Court rejected his administration's reasoning for putting a citizenship question on the census form. Trump could sign an executive order to try and make it happen anyway, but there are other options on the table, according to Attorney General William Barr.
You know, we've been considering all the options, and I've been in constant discussions with the president ever since the Supreme Court decision came down. And I think over the next day or two, you'll see what approach we're taking. And I think it does provide a pathway for getting the question on the census.
Not clear how the courts would react if the Trump administration does keep pushing to include the citizenship question on the census. What seems certain is that the mere possibility that the question could be on the form is already impacting how immigrants are thinking about the census. For many, there's a fear that taking part in the government count could jeopardize their status in this country. We're going to hear a couple of different perspectives on that now from immigrants who've been giving this a lot of thought. We begin with Josue Romero. What would he do when a census worker knocks on his door?
It feels like a question that you would never want to answer. It makes you feel exposed. As an undocumented person, that's kind of like your most guarded secret.
Romero was born in Honduras. When he was 4 years old, his family made their way to Texas without documentation. Romero has DACA status, but he came close to being deported in 2017. And he says being asked about your citizenship is a red flag for undocumented people.
Asking to share that makes you feel vulnerable, makes you feel like somebody's looking to come and get you. And having the government know that feels like it's putting yourself at risk, putting, more importantly, your family members at risk. And it's not something you would want to share.
Yeah, so it may be obvious, but explain why that information is so guarded.
I mean, you walk around, you go to work as a family, right? You do everything normally, but that one piece of information is what sets you apart from everybody around you. And when people know that, they can treat you differently. At that point, it feels like you're putting your family at risk, whether from immigration forces or, you know, just from anybody else who doesn't take too kindly to undocumented people.
Josue, put us, if you could, inside the head of someone who is approached by a census taker. Would that be an anxiety-provoking encounter or frightening even?
I want to say yes. Speaking with my father just a few moments ago, I think there's also a lack of information. I'm not sure what kind of narratives are spun as far as, like, Latino. My father primarily watches Univision, Telemundo, things like that, but I'm not sure how much information they would have about the census, right? So if somebody tells you, like, hey, we want you to fill out this form, it's going to ask you about citizenship, it does feel very uncomfortable, and it's something that I would figure you'd want to stay away from because of the question, but also just because of lack of knowledge. You don't know what this is for. You don't know why they're doing this. You don't know if what it's going to incur in the future.
Is your father undocumented?
Yes, he is.
So whether it's your father or anybody else, would the undocumented prefer not to be counted?
Yeah, divulging that information is probably scarier, but with the knowledge of like what that information is used for, I don't think there's an awareness of what the census might, like how it helps the Latino population or the immigrant population in the long run. So probably the community wouldn't want to engage, but only because of the lack of knowledge about what the census is used for and how valuable it could be in our plight regardless.
Josue Romero was born in Honduras and grew up in Texas without documentation. He's an artist living in San Antonio. Thanks very much, Josue, for your time.
Thank you so much.
Grace Martinez Rosas is also undocumented. She says she might respond to a visit from a census worker very differently.
I think that it's important who it is that knocks on my door.
Martinez Rosas was born in Hidalgo, Mexico. 22 years ago, when she was 8 years old, she and her family crossed the Rio Grande. They settled in Dallas, Texas, where Martinez Rosas grew up, not knowing about her undocumented status. Now she's a leader of the immigrants' rights group, United We Dream, and she's working to raise awareness among the undocumented about the importance of participating in the census.
United We Dream is embarking on efforts to ensure that we recruit neighbors from those neighborhoods to ensure that the people knocking on the door are your neighbors, people that you know and that can trust and can walk you through the very complicated piece about what the census is. Because it's not just a form. It is a statement of saying, I am here, I live here, this is my community, and this is my way of being able to get the resources and the representation that I deserve as someone that pays taxes in this community, which is everyone in this country, including undocumented people. So I would open my door and I will sit with my neighbor that works with United We Dream to count everybody. And I'll be able to walk someone through ensuring that they're able to fill out the application and as well as they possibly can.
So you're saying that you would answer that question and you would advise other people to answer it?
There is a duty for all of us to be able to fill out the census and be counted. It is our right as people that live in this country. And so, you know, we don't know where we're going to land on the citizenship question. There's still a lot of stuff in the air. We've seen Donald Trump be clear about wanting to use it against people of color. But we are also clear that we're not going to stop until all of our people are counted.
But answering the question, are you a citizen, yes or no? Do you approve of that?
I think that that question is unfair. I think that it's meant to be able to drive fear in our hearts. It's also, unfortunately, part of an awful tradition of the census being used for racially charged actions. I think we can think back to the Japanese internment camps and how the census information was actually used to be able to round up Japanese Americans in internment camps. And so I think that it's important for us to be able to be grounded in the history, to go into this process with eyes wide open, but that we're doing so with a clear goal of ensuring that we have what we deserve, which is the power of representation in this country.
Graysa, I imagine volunteering this sort of information about your status, handing it over to authorities, could be a very emotional issue for people like you who are undocumented and have undocumented family members. Just how fraught is that decision?
Look, I remember signing up for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, and I was asked to give up all of my information to be able to have protection for 2 years. It is a scary moment. It is something that I had to do with the full backing of my family. And so although this is different, the census is different, some of the same principles apply. We're doing this counting because we believe that we're a part of communities that will have each other's back, because we think that that's the right pieces to do to ensure that we have what we need, and because it's part of our duty.
As we wait to find out whether this citizenship question will be on the form or not, are immigrants you know talking about whether it's going to be on it?
Of course. I can't tell you the number of times as I visit people across the country that they ask me, so like, what's going to happen with the census? Should we fill it out? My mom or my dad are afraid about what it means to fill it out, even people that are legal permanent residents. And I think that my answer to them has always been, one, you're not alone. We're going to figure this out together. Two, it is our right and part of our responsibility as people to live here to be counted. And three, if we are to be able to reclaim our democracy from those that have usurped it now, we need to be able to have political power. And for that, we need to be counted.
Graysa Martinez Rosas was born in Hidalgo, Mexico, and arrived in the U.S. when she was 8 years old without documentation. Graysa, thanks very much for speaking with us and sharing your thoughts today.
Thanks for having me.
Immigration is top line in Europe, too, and one of the leading anti-immigrant voices there is Italy's Interior Minister, Matteo Salvini. He's tried to close Italy's ports to vessels carrying migrants, and today he oversaw the official shutting down of a former migrant detention center in Sicily. It was once the largest in Europe, but now its occupants have been processed out or relocated by Italian authorities. Journalist Stefania Dignotti is in Catania, Sicily, not far from the camp at Mineo. What happened today?
So the Minister of Interior, Matteo Salvini, arrived today and he gave a press release in front of local journalists, and he officially closed the camp today.
So bottom line, this camp is closing. Not many migrants in the camp compared to even a year ago. Where did the migrants go?
Last week, the last bus with migrants left. A year ago, Matteo Salvini said that the camp was going to close. And today he said that he was going from words to facts. He didn't really explain where the migrants are going. It's not really clear. But some of them have been moved to a secondary reception camps, and others are basically just going to be on the streets from now on.
How's that going to work out? I mean, do we know how many migrants might be on the streets? And are those streets all in Sicily, or could they be going to the mainland?
There are no official numbers yet, because after the Salvini decree, many migrants are losing their humanitarian protection status. The Mineo camp was hosting around 4,000 migrants until a year ago, and then they slowly decreased. The last bus that left last week was carrying around like 2 dozens of them. So in the past year, in the past few months, they've been sending some outside of the camp. So it's been like a slowly ongoing process.
Politically, for Salvini, it must look good for him to be standing in front of a camp and saying it's closing. What else did he say? What other messages did he have today?
He said that Mineo camp was actually a threat to local citizens because it's a very small village in the countryside of Sicily. And he basically said these migrants were a threat to local agricultural workers and families there. And he also said very briefly that, I mean, there was kind of a burden for military forces patrolling the camp 24/7. So he said that now, like, the situation will be better after the camp is closed and the area will be safer, and he's going to promote the rebuilding of the camp and, like, making it into something different.
Is there any evidence that the camps were unsafe for the locals?
There's actually no evidence. I mean, he was just saying that, but actually it was kind of the opposite, because you probably heard that there's a lot of exploitation of cheap labor from migrants who actually work for like €2 a day in Sicilian fields. So they were actually vulnerable.
So there were people who worked at the camp. What'll happen to those workers?
Yeah, they were laid off, and there were actually protests today. The protests actually began a year ago when the closure of the camp was announced. And that's actually quite an important point, because migration has been giving jobs to many Sicilians in the past few years since the beginning of the refugee crisis. And that's something that's not very tackled on Italian media. Sicily is like one of the poorest regions in Europe. It's like top 10 poorest regions, and migration has been an opportunity for many people to have jobs.
I mean, it's pretty complex. A migrant camp in Sicily now closed, migrants now out, but we don't know where, people without jobs who were working inside the camp. You're from Sicily yourself, Stefania. What is the range of opinions you hear among your friends and family about the whole migration issue and how the Italian government has handled it?
I think Sicily is a little different because we've been welcoming migrants since the 1980s, and at the time, there were no headlines. I mean, we were just welcoming them because Sicily is a crossroad in the Mediterranean, and it's always been a point of safe passage for migrants coming from North Africa or the Middle East. And I think the current rhetorics are trying to push for a change in that kind of opinion in Sicily. So I feel like local citizens are kind of split in the public opinion. So I would say like there's a little like 50 percent each people like thinking that, you know, welcoming migrants is a duty for us, and others who are thinking like maybe we should protect our borders. The situation is pretty fragmented at the moment.
Yeah, like I said, it is complex. Journalist Stefania Dignotti in Catania, Sicily. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
From the soccer field to the boardroom, a reality check on closing the gender pay gap. That's up next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Maybe you watched the U.S. women's national soccer team take home the World Cup over the weekend, and you're thinking about equal pay.
If you look at, you know, how that team is performing, what they're doing, what they're delivering, they're actually doing so much better than the male soccer team.
Sadia Zahidi says this is a perfect example of what's happening in other professions, too. Zahidi is with the World Economic Forum in Geneva, Switzerland, and she's been researching the gender pay gap on a global scale.
Yeah, we found that in the last decade or so, the pay that men used to have about 12 years ago, women have finally managed to reach in terms of the global average now. And the gap has, in fact, widened in that period of time because men's pay has increased so much more in the course of the last 10 to 12 years. Why is that? I think it's because, one, there is still this continued gap when it comes to the care infrastructure, and women are still primarily responsible for providing the care responsibilities in most families.
So let's look at this kind of somewhat differently, in the reverse, the home care part of this. I know some stay-at-home dads, but very few still. Won't that number have to increase?
It's not just childcare. It's also elder care. It's, you know, aging societies. It's very young societies in other parts of the world. And there is a broader opportunity here for job creation when it comes to essentially developing the care economy. And there's not a lot of evidence to support this, but there's some speculation about where we could be heading in the future, where women essentially have a comparative advantage when it comes to the care sector. It's just that it happens to be a very informal sector and it happens to be a very low-paid sector. So we've actually turned that around, used that comparative advantage, and get a lot more women into well-paid, well-regulated, certified roles inside the care economy. Mm. But we're a long way from having formalized that, and very few economies have started thinking about that as an actual job creation opportunity.
If we're just talking about closing the gender gap, the pay gap, your research shows, your research for the World Economic Forum shows that for some countries, it's going to take more than 200 years to close the gap. And I'm not talking about Pakistan or Iran here. I'm speaking of the U.S.
Yeah, so the U.S. is ranked 51 at the moment, or in last year's study, out of 149 countries. And you're absolutely right. It will take more than 200 years to close that gap in the U.S. In fact, countries like Saudi Arabia are bound to close the gap faster if they stay on the current trajectory as compared to the United States.
Really?
A large part of that stalling has to do with the sort of broader economic gender gap. A second part of it is political leadership. And I think political leadership is another area where the U.S. is lagging behind when it comes to parliamentary positions, when it comes to ministerial level positions. And of course, the U.S. has not had a female head of government, unlike an increasingly large number of countries that have.
Can things only get better, or is there a chance for things to get even worse?
In the U.S., there's a massive shortage, for example, of people with computer science and data science skills. Now, how is that shortage going to be fulfilled? And I think a lot of companies are starting to realize they have to actually reach out into either minority groups, or they have to start looking at women as part of that pipeline of talent instead of limiting themselves to the groups that they're looking at.
I'm imagining that you had to have been looking at some historical precedents to determine how events might unfold that would favor progress in closing the pay gap. I mean, to say that it'll take like 500 years for the gender gap to end in Iran and Pakistan, or, you know, over 200 years in the U.S. I mean, what do you base that on?
It's absolutely within our control to decide how fast we want to close some of these gender gaps. In the Nordic countries, this is not about historical inertia. This is about the policies that they're very deliberately putting in place, whether that is about mandating pay parity inside the workplace and otherwise having very significant penalization for companies that do not provide that kind of pay parity, whether that is paternity leave, which is something that they've really sort of put in place and accelerated on in the last decade only. I think this is not about historical trends moving out into the future unless we do nothing.
Sadia Zahidi speaking with us from the World Economic Forum in Geneva, Switzerland. Thank you.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
Here's a story now about seven women who made some history. 150 years ago, they were stopped from graduating as doctors from the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. But this weekend, they finally got their degrees, posthumously, of course. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has a story of the Edinburgh Seven.
One afternoon in 1870, a mob of about 200 people, including some really angry medical students, surrounded a lecture hall on campus. It was where a group of seven female medical students, the only women enrolled in the University of Edinburgh, and incidentally, the only women ever enrolled at any university in the UK. It was where they were scheduled to take a test.
So as the women approached the gate, there was rubbish that was hurled at them and mud that was hurled at them, and they were very verbally abused as well.
Joe Spiller is a researcher at the University of Edinburgh.
And it was one of the students that eventually opened the gate to them and let them in. And the women went into the hall and they sat their anatomy exam. And whilst they were sitting the exam, the mob outside pushed a sheep through the door of the examination hall. And Professor Handyside, who was the professor at the time, said, look, the sheep can stay because it's got more intelligence than that group of people outside put together.
The Surgeons' Hall riot, as it became known, was covered in the press, and pretty soon the whole country began debating whether a woman should be allowed to become a doctor. Even Charles Darwin weighed in on the side of the women. Eventually, the Edinburgh Seven were set to graduate at the top of their class, but opposition was mounting within the university.
A petition was signed by 500 of the 550 medical students that said, you know, had we known that the university had intended to take this course of action and to admit women as students, we would never have chosen the university as ours. There were letters that were written to the papers at the time saying that clearly the university didn't care about its reputation, it didn't care about standards, it didn't care about the sense of prestige. So the university was under a lot of pressure.
And in the end, the university got the courts to say that the women couldn't graduate and should have never been accepted in the first place. But this weekend, the University of Edinburgh decided it was time to right this historical wrong. The school chose 7 female medical students to accept degrees on behalf of the Edinburgh Seven. Caitlin Taylor represented Matilda Chaplin.
I think it's really important what's happening today to recognise the achievements of these women. But I also think it's a useful gesture that will hopefully bring a spotlight onto ongoing gender-based issues in healthcare that still exist.
Issues like the lack of women as hospital CEOs, as deans of medical schools, and as top editors at medical journals. As for the Edinburgh Seven, they didn't let the university's decision hold them back. Sophia Jex-Blake, for example, who is the ringleader of the Edinburgh Seven, finally got her medical degree in Switzerland. She then moved back to the UK and became Scotland's first practicing female doctor and went on to establish 2, count them, 2 medical schools for women. And the University of Edinburgh finally allowed the first women doctors to graduate in 1896. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Afghanistan's peace talks are progressing slowly, but they still offer hope for the future.
We compare things to where they stand today to where they were a few months ago. They were not even willing to meet a government official, and now they are accepting to meet more than a dozen of them. So, step at a time.
I'm Marco Werman. That story and more coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. It was big news in Hong Kong today. The leader of the local Hong Kong government, Carrie Lam, announced that a controversial extradition bill was, quote, dead. This is the bill that would have allowed the island to extradite Hong Kongers to mainland China to face trial. Hong Kongers have taken to the streets in recent weeks. One march counted over 1 million demonstrators to oppose the legislation. The concern was that the measure could be used by China's communist authorities to silence pro-democracy activists in the territory. The massive protests eventually forced Chief Executive Carrie Lam to suspend debate on the bill. She even apologized for it. But today she acknowledged that many residents of the former British colony just did not believe her.
There are still lingering doubts about the government's sincerity or worries whether the government will restart the process in the Legislative Council. So I reiterate here, there is no such plan. The bill is dead.
Most of the protests in Hong Kong recently have been peaceful, but some did turn violent. So also today, Lam urged residents to avoid violence in the future.
A very small minority of protesters have used the occasion to resort to violent acts and vandalism. We are set to see these violent acts because they undermine the rule of law in Hong Kong. So I make a very sincere plea here that in future, if anyone in Hong Kong have any different views, especially those about Hong Kong government's policies, please continue to uphold the value of expressing it in a peaceful and orderly manner.
The response from protest leaders in Hong Kong was probably not what Carrie Lam was hoping to hear. One of the city's most prominent student activists, Joshua Wong, went so far as to suggest that Lam was lying today, especially when she said that the extradition bill was dead. Wong noted the measure still has not been withdrawn from the legislative process.
Hong Kong government could reactivate the bill again until next year, July. Of course, suspension and stop the legislation process is better than nothing. But absolutely, the bill is not dead yet.
Wong said the people of Hong Kong had no choice but to continue their protests until the extradition bill was fully withdrawn.
The movements still continue, and we urge to terminate the bill instead of just playing the word games and say that, oh, the bill is dead. And in fact, they can turn the bill alive easily. So in the long run, we ask for free election and democracy. But in the short run, we're still asking for terminate the bill.
Activists in Hong Kong are also demanding that the government launch an official investigation into police brutality following a crackdown by security forces on protesters. The Chinese government, meanwhile, has shown no signs of giving in to the protesters' demands in Hong Kong, and it continues to back Carrie Lam and the other pro-Beijing leaders there. Peace talks between the U.S. and Taliban representatives ended today. The negotiations were held in Doha, Qatar, and hosted by the Qatari and German governments. This is the seventh time the U.S. and the Taliban have sat down to discuss peace in Afghanistan. The goal is big, ending nearly two decades of war in the country. Zalmay Khalilzad, the Trump administration's chief negotiator, praised the outcome. In a tweet, he congratulated the participants for finding common ground. But as the world's Shirin Jafari reports, major sticking points remain.
Plumes of smoke covered the sky in Kabul last week. Helicopters circled the area. A somber sign of yet another attack carried out by the Taliban. This one was not too far from the American embassy. As officials in Kabul counted the dead, most of them children, delegates from the Taliban sat across American representatives in a glitzy hotel ballroom in Doha, Qatar. American and Taliban representatives were meeting for the seventh time. Their goal is to reach a peace deal that would end almost two decades of war in Afghanistan. The Taliban delegation is all men, dressed in traditional white robe, black vests, and turbans. The American team is led by Zalmay Khalilzad, an Afghan-American diplomat. President Trump appointed Khalilzad 9 months ago and tasked him with a daunting assignment: negotiate a peace deal with the Taliban and get the U.S. out of Afghanistan. Speaking with an Afghan television program today, Khalilzad said there have been major progress in the talks. But major sticking points remain. One of the biggest points of contention is that the Taliban doesn't want to sit down with the current Afghan government. That leaves the government pretty much on the sidelines of the negotiations. The closest the Afghan government and the Taliban have come to sitting down for talks is what happened yesterday.
We have all concluded that the best way to reach peace is to have dialogue and interaction.
Shahrzad Akbar is the deputy national security advisor for the Afghan government. She attended the talks in Doha and met with Taliban officials. I reached there outside the room where the talks took place. She was speaking quietly.
I'm sorry, I'm also holding my son.
Akbar is at the negotiations not as a representative of the Afghan government, but as a private citizen, as an Afghan woman. This was part of the agreement for these talks. And Akbar wanted to make his statement. She held her two-month-old son in her arms as she sat across the table from the Taliban. The group has historically denied Afghan women basic rights. I asked her what it was like sitting across from them.
I couldn't spend as much time in informal discussions as informal engagements as I would have liked.
Akbar tells me she had to step out a couple of times to feed her son, but that her husband, also an Afghan government official, helped take care of the baby.
It meant something that I attended these talks as a new mom, and I'm happy he was part of this hopefully historic engagement.
The Taliban carried out more attacks as they discussed peace in Doha yesterday. A car bomb in the central province of Ghazni left scores of people dead and injured. But Omar Zakhirwal, Afghan ambassador to Pakistan, is optimistic about these talks.
We compare things to where they stand today to where they were a few months ago. They were not even willing to meet a government official, and now they are accepting to meet more than a dozen of them. So, step at a time.
A step at a time, Zakhirwal told the BBC yesterday. But the Americans want to see results soon. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has set a deadline of September 1st for a final peace deal to be reached. September is also when the next Afghan presidential elections are set to take place. That gives Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad less than 2 months to negotiate a ceasefire with the Taliban, end the war, and start bringing U.S. troops back home. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The peace talks in Doha are just one of several reasons the Trump administration pays attention to Qatar. Another is Qatar's strategic location on a peninsula that juts out into the Gulf that separates Saudi Arabia from Iran. The country is also home to America's largest air base in the Middle East. 11,000 U.S. troops there, all ready for action anywhere in the region. One big problem, though. America's other friends in the Gulf, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, see Qatar as an outlaw, even an enemy. And as the Trump administration builds up its military presence in the region to counter Iran, this regional spat among neighbors complicates things. Elizabeth Dickinson understands the situation well. She's a senior analyst for the Arabian Peninsula at the International Crisis Group and joins us from the United Arab Emirates. Why did the Emir of Qatar come to Washington? Let's start there, Elizabeth.
Well, I think it's part of an accelerating relationship that we've seen between Qatar and the United States, particularly since Qatar's neighbors broke off relations in 2017. So one of the unintended sort of consequences of that blockade is that it really forced Qatar to double down on its relationship with the U.S.
Last year, when the Saudi Crown Prince was in Washington, the talk was all about trade. Same thing with the Emir of Qatar. Are Gulf leaders cozying up to President Trump by reminding him about their money?
Well, I think Qatar has made a very concerted effort to remind the president how important the relationship is to the U.S. So some of the headlines from this visit, for example, are Qatar's building of a surveillance plane in South Carolina that's creating a number of jobs, Qatar Airlines purchasing U.S.-made aircraft, creating hundreds of thousands of jobs. So these sorts of headlines about the U.S. economy, I think, play quite well with the administration, and the Gulf states have certainly picked up on that and are using it to their advantage.
The Saudis and the Emiratis are not terribly fond of Qatar. Why do they dislike Qatar?
Yeah, so I think this dispute really, we can take it back to the Arab Spring and the very different reactions that the Qataris and the Saudis and the Emiratis had to the uprisings. I think Qatar, particularly through its media network, Al Jazeera, was very supportive of the uprisings and particularly the sort of Muslim Brotherhood currents of some of the political forces that emerged after those uprisings. By contrast, the Saudi Arabia and the UAE, I think, really saw it as a threat to the region's stability and really a concern for their own stability as well. They saw this tide of sort of Islamist influence sweeping across the region, very much backed by Qatar and Turkey. They found themselves on opposite sides of the conflicts that emerged in Libya, in Syria, in Egypt, across the board. They just have very different visions of what sort of region they'd like to see, and that basically blew up in 2017 when they ended up breaking ties with Qatar.
Yeah, so that was a little over 2 years ago. Qatar was actually punished by the Saudis with a blockade. What happened there, and are the feelings still sore today?
I would say, if anything, the feelings have gotten more entrenched. I think the Qataris have found that the boycott, blockade, however you want to call it, has really played to their advantage in many ways. I think on the Saudi UAE side, they continue to see all of the things that caused alarm for them 2 years ago have, if anything, only accelerated since then.
And why is this a problem for the United States?
Well, this is a problem for the United States because it's really just sort of a headache. They would like to see the Gulf countries work together on their priority, which is countering Iran's influence in the region. And I guess the U.S. sees it as really a distraction to have the Gulf countries at odds with one another.
So if the Saudis still have friction with Qatar, does that make Qatar an ally of Iran? And what does that mean for U.S. policy?
Well, I think something that has happened after the blockade is immediately afterwards, Qatar had to rewrite the book about how it got its goods. So this is a small island. It's a desert country. Something like 80 or 90% of all of its food and commercial goods are sort of imported. So most of those goods used to come through the other Gulf countries. And when they blockaded Qatar, they had to come up with another way to get all these products on their shelves. And one of the ways that they found was Iran. So Iran has supplied produce to the country. The other very clear commercial relationship that's developed is through Qatar Airways. One of the things that the Saudis and the UAE and Bahrain did is they blockaded the airspace, which means that every Qatar Airways flight going in and out of Doha has to fly over Iran. So I think by default, Qatar has been forced to create a deeper relationship with Iran than they had before. In terms of their political positioning, I see Qatar being very cautious about Iran and the role that it plays in the region. However, the way that they deal with that threat is different than the way that the Saudis and the Emiratis do. The Qataris have to engage. They have basically no other choice.
Elizabeth Dickinson, senior analyst at the International Crisis Group, speaking with us from Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. Elizabeth, thank you very much. It was great to speak with you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
We in radio have a love affair with the human voice, the unique sound of one person's vocal expression. How about 90,000 people at once, though? The Estonia Song and Dance Festival has just wrapped in the capital Tallinn. Every 5 years, Estonians congregate in a huge open-air amphitheater for 4 days of choirs and audiences singing their hearts out en masse. The festival started back in 1869, a time when Estonian national identity was coming into its own. Learning the Estonian language and singing Estonian songs were ways to cement that identity. Who'd have known back then that 150 years later, festival goers would be waving blue, black, and white Estonian flags and decked out in national costume in 90,000-part harmony. The Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo has both local authorities and the international community worried. More than 1,500 people have died since the emergency started almost a year ago. And at the center of the fight, Congolese doctors trying to treat their patients.
Hello.
Hi, Dr. Kojin. This is Marco.
Okay.
All right. And you're in the town of Beni. Dr. Richard Kojin is in the city of Beni in northeastern Congo. He took a moment between patients to speak with us, standing right outside the intensive care unit of his Ebola treatment center. Now, you might imagine an Ebola treatment unit would put patients in very isolated rooms with doctors wearing those really thick plastic coveralls, also known as personal protective equipment, or PPEs. The center is not like that. Kojin says his staff right now is caring for 19 confirmed Ebola patients in semi-stable condition and six more who are very sick.
They are really, really unstable. And for six patients, we have one doctor for three patients, and we have one nurse for one patient.
And how are you treating these people? Like, if somebody is unstable, what do you have to do? What can you do?
We have to follow the kidney function, we have to follow the liver function, we have to follow the lungs function, so we have to follow all vital function.
Right, for medical professionals like you, Dr. Coach, I mean, it's a constant monitoring process. Tell me about the last person you treated. Were they panicked or scared?
The last patient for today, I see, is a children, 14 months.
14 months, so and, not even a year and a half.
14 months, is in septic shocks, and he's very unstable. So he receives blood, he receives the drugs to protect their stomach, to protect their lung function, to protect the liver function.
And how is the child's family coping with his illness?
One of the good things in this outbreak is that our design, it facilitates the contact between the patient and their family, between the family and us, the health workers. So the family, they are there, they see their children, and we discuss with them, we explain them all the situation, all evolution about their children. They sit around the cube near their children all time they need.
Dr. Kojan, before we talk about this innovation, the cube, remind us how Ebola is spread and how do you, as healthcare workers and doctors, keep from getting infected?
I hope that I understand well your question.
C'est-à-dire, Ebola, comment est-il répandu et comment est-ce que vous, en tant que docteur, évite d'être infecté?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Brièvement.
You know, this is a problem, you know, for this outbreak. Until now, we don't know the index case, because with the index case, we will understand well how this outbreak is start, you know. But the contamination is the same for all Ebola outbreak, you know. The contamination is by the fluids. When you touch the dead body, you know, when you touch all biologic liquids. So we receive some health workers contaminated in some health centers from many villages. So their contamination start by, they examine the patient, confirm case without know all information about the suspect case. And after that, they start sick. But we not yet registered the contamination in our team.
It all starts with, as you say, with human biological liquid, sweat or urine or bile. So far, the healthcare workers at your center have not been affected, contaminated. Perhaps that's because of this innovation that Alima, your organization, has come up with. We were talking about it earlier, the cubes. I'm checking out a photo of one of them. It's totally transparent. Like the doctors and patients can see each other through them. What makes these cubes different than the kind of isolation that was used in the big Ebola outbreak in 2014 in West Africa?
Before this outbreak, I work in the traditional city with a big, strong isolation for the patient. Yeah, it was very hard to work in this condition, you know, with a strong PPE, with a heavy PPE, with, you can't stay with the patient long time. Many things change, you know, now I don't have a PPE. So I see the patient, I meet with the patient. So I can stay every time with the patient. And, you know, with the cube, we have a possibility to touch the patient without the full PPE.
You've actually got kind of latex gloves that go inside the cube from the outside, correct?
Yeah, I can help the patient to eat without the risk, the contamination risk, you know.
It sounds like big progress from 2014. Have you found that it's increased trust? Are people more willing to come to the Ebola Treatment Center because of these cubes?
Exactly.
Dr. Kojan, the numbers of deaths, though, continues to climb from this Ebola outbreak. What are your concerns right now?
That is our big problem, you know. The important thing we need is in the village, in the area from Beni, we need to support those health centers to increase the biosecurity in those area centers to establish the confidence between the community, the population, and the whole system, healthcare system. So this is the way we can receive the patient early. And when we receive the patient early, I'm sure we have all the standard of care, we have all drugs, we have a vaccine, we have many ways we can help the patient and we can decrease significantly the number of dead patients under Ebola.
Congolese Dr. Richard Kojan is president of ALIMA, the Alliance for International Medical Action. He's been speaking with us from the Ebola Treatment Center in Beni in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Dr. Kojan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Kojan, describe the CUBE units set up at a center to treat Ebola patients. You can see photos of what those units look like at theworld.org. And that's all the time we got for today. I'm Marco Werman. The world's theme music is by Ned Porter, and we come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. We'll see you back here tomorrow.